Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Dean Mitchell. Grab a cup of coffee, settle in with your favorite listening device or viewing tablet, or if you're in a car, buckle up. You're about to enter the smartest doctor in the room. You know, last week's podcast, if you weren't aware, I was really fortunate to interview two leading researchers from the University of Pennsylvania's medical program on long COVID. And there were some really important new findings that were discussed. So if you get a chance, you should really listen to it if you have any friends or family that unfortunately are suffering from that. But even for those of us, fortunately, without long COVID, the pandemic still seems a vivid part of our daily lives. You know, for example, I was reading in the New York Times, a mother in Chicago, Jessie Thompson, was quoted as saying, she's reminded of the pandemic almost every day. You know, and people have said that they have made changes in their lives that are subtle but unmistakable. Their world feels a little bit smaller, with less socializing and fewer crowds. Some parents who homeschool their children never had them go back to regular school. And as we all well know, hybrid remote work has become a staple of many companies. So when is this all going to be over? Today, I have back on the podcast one of my go-to experts on anything related to infections and vaccines. It's Dr. Paul Offit. Dr. Offit has written a new book, and he is quite prolific, but all his books are terrific, as I have, and I've interviewed him on some of the other ones, You Bet Your Life, Vaccinated. You know, you can tell I'm an Offit fan. But his new book, Tell Me When It's Over, is really required reading for anyone. You know, it's an insider's guide to deciphering COVID myths and navigating our post-pandemic world. You know, not all of you have the good fortune. Like, when I have a question, I could reach out to Dr. Offit. Not all of you will have his personal email. So you're going to want to read this book because it has a lot of practical advice, and we're going to get into that. Dr. Offit, with again his pristine credentials, he's the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, better known as CHOP among us medical people. He's also the Maurice Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a Professor of Pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, and he's an advisory member of the FDA's Vaccine Committee. But I have to tell you, more importantly than all those amazing credentials, whenever Dr. Offit appears in front of the media, I quickly grab my seat, because he gives you the information straight up. It's no wishy-washy. I mean, if you ever watch these news shows, you get people on, whether it's lawyers or whatever, they're, oh, it could be this, it could be that. He's like, if he doesn't know, he tells you. And if he has a pretty good idea, he'll tell you that too. So I'm really so happy to have Dr. Paul Offit back on this podcast for the fourth time.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
All right. At least I got a smile out of you. That's good. So Dr. Offit, first we have to deal with public perception. And we're going to get into different chapters in your book. But what is a little bit confusing to everybody is that COVID doesn't seem to be as serious a threat anymore. Do you agree? And is this good or bad?
I agree. I think we have a very high degree of population immunity, probably greater than 98% of people have been naturally infected or vaccinated or both. I think that the number of people who are hospitalized or die every week has dramatically decreased for that reason. I think if you define pandemic as something that changes the way we live, work, or play, that for the most part, this pandemic is over. But the virus isn't over. The virus is now going to likely join the pantheon of winter respiratory viruses, which will every year cause likely tens of thousands to be hospitalized and thousands to die every year. So the virus isn't over. So I think that's the trick now, how to deal with it at this point.
Okay. You know, I'm going to quote another doctor who's also, he's actually a sociology professor at Yale, Dr. Nicholas Christakis. I actually have his book here too, called, it's interesting. I haven't gotten through all of it though, Apollo's Arrow. I don't know if you're familiar with it, you know, but he said something pretty interesting that I thought, you know, he said, we all have had very different experiences, you know, during this COVID pandemic. You know, frontline workers like doctors and nurses or policemen really faced serious threats, especially, you know, the initial wave of infection. Other people, you know, work from home or move to warm climates to remain outside. And he said, this is why we don't really sort of have this collective memory. Do you also agree with that? Is that some of the issue here, that our experience, you know, that, again, there are people like, oh, COVID really wasn't so bad. They made a big deal out of it. And other people like, oh, I had a friend of mine who's a doctor. His cardiologist died in the pandemic because he was I think at NYU, he was pulled to the front line to work on the hospital wards where probably the viral load was heavy. He got infected and he unfortunately passed away. So, you know, and actually, I just had a patient the other day in the office. She was 30 years old. Both her parents, I mean, they had lung issues, but they both passed away from COVID. So do you think that, I guess my question is, you know, that again, you know, about whether it's a serious threat anymore. And I think it's nice that you're telling people you can sort of relax a little bit, but do you think that still confuses people?
Yes. I think I'll give you a perfect example. So I'm in Florida right now. And a couple of weeks ago, I was flying from Florida back to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And I was waiting in the airport, you know, for the plane. And so there's 50 or 60 people around me. And there's a man who works for the airport who was sort of sweeping up in front of us. And he had a bad respiratory tract infection. He was coughing. He was sneezing. His nose was running. He was wiping his nose on his sleeve. And I'm watching as he's walking up and down the aisles as people progressively have more and more frightened looks on their faces as he gets closer and closer. And finally, surprisingly, actually, one woman said to him, "Did you test yourself?" And he proudly said, "Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I'm COVID negative." And to him, he's good. But, you know, it's not just COVID that can cause a problem. And I think that influenza every year causes between 20,000 and 60,000 people to die. Right. If you're an older person, or respiratory syncytial virus causes 10,000, 14,000 people to die every year. Parainfluenza causes 50,000 hospitalizations a year. So all those viruses are bad. And I think when the CDC recently said, look, you should just sort of stay home if you can until you're feeling better, at which point presumably you'll be shedding much less virus, and then you can go out. People thought, oh my God, we're just making light of this virus. Things are only going to get worse. And although I agreed with that recommendation, I think that actually made sense. But probably in a better world, here's my better world, Dean. Tell me whether this makes sense.
I want to hear, that's what we were going to get to, but yeah, let's hear it now.
In my better world, If you are in a high-risk group, so we're trying to keep people out of the hospital. So who gets hospitalized? It's people generally in four high-risk groups: people over 75, people who have high-risk medical conditions, chronic lung or heart disease, kidney disease, people who are pregnant, and people who are immune compromised. That's who gets hospitalized for the most part and dies. So we need to keep them out of the hospital.
Right.
If you're in a high-risk group and you have respiratory symptoms, test yourself. If you're positive, treat yourself early with an antiviral. If you're not in a high-risk group, assume you have one of these viruses. Stay home if you can until you feel better. And if you can't, because not everybody can stay home, because, you know, sick leave policies are different with different companies, at least wear a mask until you're feeling better.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to get into that because it was, you know, when the CDC came out, okay, nobody has to stay home anymore if you test positive for COVID. I mean, I thought that was ridiculous, because if somebody even had the flu, I would say, do not come to my office, whether you're staff or patients, and you're going to get other people infected. And, I, you know, for example, and I want to get into the symptoms or lack of symptoms. You know, I thought this was a bizarre, you know, statement, because it was printed from the CDC director, Mandy Cohn, Dr. Mandy Cohn. She goes, "We want folks to recognize that the majority of viruses spread happening when you're sickest. And as the days go on, less virus spreads." And that's really, I know that from personal, I know that you say that it's not truly in your book. I mean, COVID has been so contagious because it's so pernicious, it's sneaky. I mean, people are very, can have very high loads before they're, you know, showing illness, right? So, and the whole idea too, and we've talked about this, sometimes patients have no fever. So they say, well, you know, wait till you have a day of no fever. Well, you might not have any fever. So, you know, my senses, you know, it's funny, I was in Florida a few weeks ago, and unfortunately half my trip was ruined. I got a little lax. I'm very careful usually on planes. Planes are my Achilles heel. I seem to get sick whenever I'm, you know, if it's possible. And I told people never use the bathroom on the plane unless you're dying. But, you know, nobody around me was coughing. I mean, maybe there was a little child behind me. I wasn't really sure, but who could know? So again, my point is, I think testing is still important. I tell my patients all the time too, even when it's possible, test for the other viruses, just so you know, you don't go on antibiotics unnecessarily. But do you really agree that, I mean, let me ask you this question. one of your grandchildren, I think you are your grandfather, or, you know, your son or daughter, they said, oh, Dad, I tested positive, but, you know, we're supposed to come over this weekend. Is it okay? What would you say?
So here's what I would say. I actually don't agree with Dr. Cohn's statement that you're most contagious when you're sickest.
I know, too. I think that's totally wrong.
So COVID, like most viral respiratory diseases, occur in two phases. The first phase is the virus reproduction phase.
Right.
The virus attaches, enters hundreds of viruses, become thousands of viruses, become millions of viruses. You actually often don't have symptoms at that point.
Right.
You're most contagious the day or two before you develop symptoms. Right. Then you develop symptoms, right? Your B cells make antibodies, your T cells kill viruses, infected cells. And with that, you develop symptoms as your immune system.
As the fight's going on, you know, when your body's really fighting. You're under attack. Right.
Exactly. So now you're getting sicker and sicker as you're having this inflammatory response against the virus. Then what happens is you start to get better. You feel better. I mean, if you had fever, you don't have fever for a day. You just feel better. At that point, what your immune system is saying is, I think our job is done here, which is what they said at the end of every Lone Ranger episode, but nobody remembers not that old. But in any case, that's what your immune system is saying. I think our job is done. And at that point, viral replication is not as big of a component of the illness. So I think that Dr. Cohn's statement that as you are feeling better or you're afebrile, then you can feel more comfortable. And I think that's true. But you're most contagious before you develop symptoms.
Right. And you know, some of these patients can be coughing for 3-4 weeks. And even though they may have the worst cough, honestly, I am not as afraid when I see somebody coughing a lot. And I, for sure, as a patient, I know that they've been sick for 3 weeks. I'm like, I know they, like you said, it's the immune response and all the after effects of that. It's not any longer the viral road. The immune system has probably gone in there and done its job. But going back to my question, or, you know, if you don't want to get too personal, if it was one of your faculty or residents and they said, you know, I just tested positive for COVID, I'm not feeling so bad, Dr. Offit, should I come in and see patients even with a mask, whatever? What would you really tell them?
I guess I there's a lot of people out there who are asymptomatically positive for COVID and may remain asymptomatic. So do you quarantine them all? And if so, for how long? I guess my feeling is that I would ask them to stay home for a day or two to see whether or not they start to get sick. Because what that would mean is that they were right at the beginning of their illness, they were shedding a lot of virus at that point. And if a day or two goes by and they really don't develop any symptoms, then I feel better about it. Come in, wear a mask. But I guess I would worry for that first couple of days.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're talking about the patients that are most at risk, and you discuss this a lot in your book, which I think is really important. I mean, people really have to know if they're at risk. And I think you mentioned, I've seen other places too, being over 65. You know, I think that also can vary. There's some really healthy 65, 70-year-olds.
I said 75. See, I'm getting older.
I know. I'm 63, 70. And I'm like, I'm not that, you know, I'm immune strong, right? I mean, obviously, diabetics, we've known for many years. Interestingly, people with coronary artery disease, pulmonary disease, that makes sense. Obesity, we know, because it seems like this particular virus really attacks the circulatory system. And again, obesity seems to put them at risk. What was surprising to me was pregnancy. I always tend to think of women as being very healthy when they're pregnant. Why is that? And even with the flu, I mean, they tell, you know, women to get, make sure you get vaccinated or even get vaccinated while you're pregnant. It's okay. What is the immune issue during pregnancy?
Well, first of all, you have essentially a foreign graft, if you will, in a fetus. So you don't want to respond to that. Secondly, your lungs are wetter. You sort of have a higher blood volume. Your lungs are more susceptible than to flu or COVID causing severe and occasionally fatal pneumonia, about 2.5 times greater. So it is a state that is at higher risk. It's true, consistently.
Interesting. You know, the one thing that I think is ignored a little bit is that people don't appreciate, because I see this in my practice, so many of the patients now that are on biologics or immunosuppressive drugs for arthritis. I mean, every other commercial you watch on TV, whether it's ESPN, CNN, Fox, whatever, too, they got a lot of money for this, the drug companies. There are obviously a lot of people who are being prescribed this, you know, for colitis, for arthritis. I worry a lot for them. I mean, would you consider them fairly high risk, even if they're young?
So there's different levels of immune suppression, obviously. So the You know, say like Humira, for example, right, is to some extent immune suppressive, but not really in a way that puts you at great risk for a viral infection.
Really? Right? Okay.
You know, tumor necrosis alpha is not going to be as great as if you have multiple sclerosis and you're getting a monoclonal antibody against your B cells, you know, which make it, and that's critical. So there's different levels of immune suppression. We tend to lump everybody together.
Right.
On one end of the spectrum, you have people who are on, you know, cancer chemotherapies or
right.
Keep them from rejecting their transplants. And then on the other hand, you have, say, an asthmatic who may be on low-dose steroids. So it's all sort of a wide range. But I think anybody who's on a biological should consider themselves at higher risk and just test yourself early. And if you're positive, you know, please take an antiviral. Because if you look at who's getting hospitalized and who's dying, those high-risk groups often don't take an antiviral
early. We're just about to get into that. So yeah, at least we're leading along the way here. But is there any article, I'm just curious, that, you know, because again, I understand immunology pretty well, but I always concern that sort of, you know, that grades the different, I mean, there's a lot of them now, of those monoclonal antibodies, they're targeting so many different things, that some that are more risk, because, you know, they always say very fast, you know, on the commercials, you know, if you were at risk of TB, whatever, we know tuberculosis is one of the ones because of the way it blocks the interferon, that they're more prone to TB, but fortunately TB is not, you know, so ubiquitous anymore. But do you feel there is some gradation in those drugs that, you know, especially among the biologics that say, okay, this one, I mean, you don't have to worry as much?
Yes, and I think you should hopefully talk to, if you have an immunologist, your immunologist, or at least an immunologist, to try and figure out, and knowing your medical background, what kind of risk you're at.
Okay.
So it is important to do that for sure.
Okay. All right, let's talk about, because you were leading me along, and I really did want to get into this. You know, anybody who's watches a little TV has seen the advertising blitz. If it's COVID, take Paxlovid, and they even have Travis Kelce. I'm surprised they don't have Taylor Swift with him, getting a lot of media attention. And again, the public seems to be confused. They say, you know, yes, this should be good, great. I don't have to worry about dying from COVID. But then they all hear about the rebound phenomenon, which even President Biden had, Anthony Fauci had. I'm throwing out some big names here. And then the patients really start to question, well, what is the point if I'm going to get this rebound? And you do address this in the book, and I think you explain it really nicely. So maybe for the listeners, you can, again, say when you think someone should take Paxlovid and why they shouldn't worry so much about the rebound. And we'll talk about that a little bit.
Right. If you're in a high-risk group, you really should take an antiviral early. And Paxlovid has a number of drug-drug interactions. And so you need to talk to your doctor about whether that's true for you and what sort of the risk-benefit. Because, you know, can you stop those other drugs for a few days while you're taking Paxlovid, knowing you're at high risk, knowing you may be hospitalized or die from this virus? So I'm a big fan of Paxlovid if you're in a high-risk group early. And if you can't take Paxlovid, then molnupiravir, or if you can't take that, remdesivir. But there are other antivirals. But definitely, antivirals are underused.
What would be, Dr. Rappel, what would be a drug that you couldn't take with it? There's
a
lot.
There's a dozen drugs. And I think what happens, doctors, we get a little lazy and we think, you know, there's a drug-drug interaction, just wait and hopefully you won't have a problem. But it's
a risk-benefit ratio here. I'd rather not die from COVID and take a break from my whatever medicine that you can. Okay.
In terms of rebound, I think Paxlovid rebound isn't a thing. Just like the Philadelphia Eagles defense last year was not a thing, I think this is not a thing. So what happens is, we talked about this, as you go from that first to second phase, because now you're taking Paxlovid for 5 days, and you stop, but you're moving into the second phase of illness when your immune response starts to kick in. So people stop the Paxlovid, now your immune response is ramping up, and so your symptoms get worse. And people say, well, that's Paxlovid rebound, meaning that now that you've stopped this antiviral, that the virus replication is going to a greater degree, but that's really not it. And I think
that's important.
I think it was confusing, because what Dr. Fauci did was he gave himself a course of Paxlovid, then he stopped and he was entering his immune phase, and it was called Paxlovid rebound, and he took a second course.
I remember reading about that. Right.
Probably shouldn't have ever taken that second course.
Well, I was about to say, you know, because I was about to ask you before, does this happen with any other infections? But you know what the funny thing is? Nobody really follows up with like a flu test after they've been either treated with, the antivirals for flu or whatever. So they're just like, okay, you know, and it runs its course. So we're so busy testing so much because before we were testing whether supposedly we could go out, you know. So, I mean, honestly, a person when we think about this could be, again, people change their minds about this, but I think a lot of times you could be positive for COVID for, who knows, like 2 weeks on testing, but really be very, not that infectious, correct, after a while?
Correct, especially using PCR, where you can do a polymerase chain reaction, which is very sensitive, which is good, but it's also very sensitive, which is bad. So you can, I mean, I'm in the world, I worked on rotavirus for, you know, a quarter of a century, but, you know, you would shed infectious rotavirus for 5 or 7 days. You could be PCR positive for 6 months. I mean, so that doesn't help you. Antigen is a better test, but still the best test is not commercially available. It's a research tool, which is to look at actual infectious virus that you're shedding. That's why I think Dr. Cohn's notion of now that you're getting better, you probably aren't shedding much infectious virus anymore. But the constant testing and testing and saying, I'm going to stay home until I'm test negative is just, I think, driving us crazy.
Yeah. Okay, so we have to move on to vaccine fatigue, the pros and the cons and the confusion. There's a lot of it. I mean, you really clarify it. You, again, in some of the conversations I had with you, I can't remember if it was in our prior podcast or off of that. You know, you just explain things so well and so logically, you know, again, with an immune thinking. You know, you explained something really important in the book, which it's a little complicated, but I think the listeners should still understand this because I think I even asked you in the beginning, I was like, why can't they come up with a vaccine that lasts? Like, why does the flu shot have to be given every year? And why is this COVID thing now going to be, and we'll talk about that, going to be a yearly vaccine? And you explained really well in the book about the, you say it better than I do. I was like looking at this, that about the duration of the incubation period, sorry, that's like so key. So could you maybe explain that as best you can to the listeners about the difference between the incubation period for, you know, measles and polio, which you know all too well about, and COVID?
Sure. So incubation period is defined from the period of time from when you're first exposed to the virus to when you develop symptoms. For viruses like influenza, SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID, or respiratory syncytial virus, or parainfluenza virus, those winter respiratory viruses generally have short incubation periods, usually just a few days. And then there are viruses that have long incubation periods, like measles or German measles or polio, which can be 10 days, 14 days. When you're trying to protect against mild disease, the key component is antibodies present in your bloodstream at the time of exposure. And now, when you get naturally infected or vaccinated, you will develop antibodies in your circulation that will last 3 to 6 months. Then they'll fade again. So for a short incubation period disease like COVID, now your antibodies are low, you're exposed to the virus, you're developing now a mild illness. But to prevent severe disease, the key thing really isn't the antibodies in your circulation, it's memory cells.
Right. That's so important. You point that in the book. I just, again, for my listeners, so important what he's saying here is that, so don't get discouraged because you've gotten vaccines and you've still gotten sick after, because people are like, what the heck is this? And what Dr. Offit is explaining is that antibodies, which people sort of vaguely understand, is part of your protection, but a much deeper protection is what he's talking about, the B memory cells and T cells, which prevent you from getting really, really sick. So that's what you have to appreciate.
Right, because serious illness takes longer to develop. Mm-hmm. It's not going to develop in a few days, which is going to be true for mild illness. It'll take 7 days, 10 days. That's plenty of time for those memory cells, which are living kind of latently in your body, to become activated and differentiate and become, in the case of memory B cells, antibody secreting cells. So you can prevent serious disease for a long time. And for a long incubation disease like measles, which takes, you know, 10 days to even develop mild symptoms, you can eliminate those viruses from the world, which we did with...
Again, why? I'm sorry, can you explain again, why can that eliminate it?
Because you can prevent even mild disease, and you can even prevent transmission, which is not going to be true for a short incubation period disease. So we...
Because the B cells and the T cells jump in... You know, because it's a longer incubation. They have more time to summon the army to come in there and take care of it, right? So, okay. So, like for example, Right. Okay. So I want to make this clear. So let's just say you or I have had measles in our lifetime. I mean, I never had, you know, and I was around a child that had measles. If we had one of those today that wasn't vaccinated, I would most likely not get measles, you know, if my immune system is good, because it's, as you said, it's a longer incubation. I mean, the virus, obviously, just to understand for the listeners, the virus is getting into my system. I mean, that I can't prevent, but my immune system, especially my deeper immune system, has time to bring in the artillery to say, hey, we're going to squash this thing before it replicates and causes a lot of problems. Is that?
Yeah. So I'm a child of the 50s. I had measles.
Right.
I had too. Antibodies that I generated that then came down after probably 6 months or so.
Yeah.
I still have memory B cells and memory T cells, even now, decades later. If I'm exposed to someone with measles, the virus will begin to reproduce itself in my nose and throat, but my memory cells will kick in before I ever have any reasonable amount of mild illness or transmission. And that's why you can eliminate it. We eliminated measles from this country by the year 2000. Smallpox is a long incubation period disease. We eliminated it. Polio is a long incubation period disease. We've certainly eliminated from this country. You can eliminate those. Rubella, well, German.
Yeah,
means,
no, I know. Well, this is what made the title of your professorship, Dr. Hillman, look so good. I mean, when I read your book, The Vaccinated, and, I was like saying, this guy's a hero. I mean, I don't know, he discovered like 13 vaccines that eliminated these things. They said, like, what happened to all our heroes here? And it's just that things have gotten a little trickier, you know? So what's your feeling? Well, let's talk. That was my first question, was about the pros and cons of the boosters. And you clearly clarified in the book, you've clarified it for me before, because you mentioned, which is pretty important, people are definitely getting, vaccine fatigue. They're like, how many more of these do I have to get? And you mentioned very clearly, it was interesting, we were sort of using a lot of data from Israel, because Israel had a nice little deal with Pfizer to really vaccinate. You know, they have a very good socialized healthcare system. They were able to vaccinate a lot of people, and they were going for like 3, 4, and 5 boosters. And you point out, I think quite importantly in the book, that maybe this wasn't necessary, and especially to take that data and translate it to here so that younger people that have had the initial vaccinations and maybe be infected with COVID, you know, they don't need that booster anymore. They're sort of covered. So maybe can you explain that a little bit?
Right. So it's a really good and important point. We've sort of morphed in our language, right? Initially, we called them yearly booster doses. And every country in this world, with the exception of ours in Canada, gives a yearly booster dose of COVID to high risk groups, those 4 high risk groups that I just mentioned. And they target them. Now, flu is given as a campaign, as a yearly campaign for everybody over 6 months of age, because although there are high-risk groups, everyone really is susceptible. And you'll have as many as 75 to 150 children dying healthy, young children dying every year from flu. So get a flu vaccine every year. So I would call the yearly flu vaccine a campaign, but I wouldn't call the COVID boosters a campaign, because I'm still calling them boosters. Now, this country, the CDC it likens the two. So now we're likening flu and...
linked them now, yeah.
Right, and you see Travis Kelce, right? He gets both.
He had 2 shots there. Well, that was another question I was going to ask you, too. I have to tell you, honestly, maybe just my conservative way of approaching things, I never like, if it's possible, people getting 2 vaccines at once. I mean, again, if you have a reaction, how do you know? Why is that necessary? Just out of convenience? I mean, there's obviously immune advantage, I don't think.
No, it's convenient. I think that you just have to make sure the studies have been done. I mean, when the COVID vaccines first came out, there wasn't a lot of concomitant use data with other vaccines. As those data were generated, then you felt more comfortable. But hopefully, so why is it that this country does something pretty much no other country does, which is has a yearly COVID vaccine for everybody? And I've talked to public health officials about this, and their feeling is that although they agree with me that we should target high-risk groups, they think the best way to get those high-risk groups to get vaccinated is to vaccinate all, that a nuanced message is sort of a garbled message. And I don't see it that way. I think you can have a nuanced message, but hard to know.
Okay. Yeah, that's going to actually move into something else I wanted to talk to you about, too. And it kind of eventually we need your leadership on this. But you mentioned in the first couple of chapters of your book also about the origin of COVID-19, which there's been a lot of debate. The lab leak theory, the Wuhan market theory. You tend to come down on Wuhan market theory, if we could call it that. I was reading something else. I forgot where. I guess, what was his name? He's not a doctor, but he did a lot of research on this, citing the Diffuse Project, if you're familiar with that, you probably are, and a whole idea about this genetic engineering of the furon cleavage site, you know, on the COVID vaccine that's made it such a problem. I guess the question really is, you know, because we may not ever know, because the Chinese were never really open about this. Does it matter? Does it matter if it came from a lab or if it was from that Wuhan market? It does.
Yes. Here's why.
Tell me why.
This SARS-CoV-2 was the third pandemic virus we've had in the last 20 years, right? We had SARS-1 in 2002, MERS in 2012. Now this virus in 2019. Mm-hmm. There'll be another pandemic virus, no doubt about it. And it will likely start the same way the first three did, which is an animal-to-human spillover event, which in this case, for SARS-CoV-2, occurred in the western section of the Hunan wholesale seafood market towards the end of 2019. There was an intimate association among dozens of illegally sold animals, including bats, that were all in that area in unsanitary, unhygienic conditions. All the original cases started in that western section of the Hunan seafood market and then spread outward. There was the Chinese... You hit it actually earlier when you said the Chinese were sort of a black box. I mean, they were not good about letting international teams of scientists come in and evaluate it, which led to these conspiracy theories. They didn't want to claim responsibility for this. But they did do genetic analysis of things like, you know, the carts and the devices that were used to kill the animals, the devices that were used to brush the animals' hair and the crates and stuff. And you see genetic evidence of this virus there, including in a raccoon dog. I think all the evidence is on that side. On the other side, it's just sort of conspiracy and innuendo. And this whole furin issue is that this cleavage site is not found in nature. But it is found in nature. And Rand Paul tried to make the case that the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein is not found in nature. But it is found in nature. So there's a great podcast called Decoding the Gurus. And there's three evolutionary biologists, Michael Worby and Chris Anderson and Eddie Holmes, who go through for like almost 3 hours all the data on why this was not a lab leak. So I think it's important because there'll be another pandemic, and you want to try and make sure that we don't then allow the situation to occur where there will be another pandemic, and more importantly, that we instantly identify it so we can respond to it. We shouldn't have had to have depended on a whistleblower in China to tell us that there was a virus that was killing people. I mean, right. He ultimately died of the virus, became a hero, but,
right,
but
Dr.
it has to be better surveillance and international cooperation. So it does matter.
Yeah. Okay. That's super important. I guess I wanted to ask you, because again, it leads me up to this too. If Dr. Paul Offit was the czar of pandemics, I'm giving you ultimate authority across CDC, NIH, whatever, too. What would, you know, and you know, there was a lot of mismessaging. You mentioned that in the book. It's unfortunate. It really is. Because, you know, we have some of these most elite institutions. I mean, for years, the CDC, I mean, the NIH. I mean, really, I mean, it's sad what this did to their reputation. But again, you know, the future president of the United States says, okay, we can't afford this. We are going to hopefully fund again, you know, this department. But we need better coordination and communication because it's screwing everything up. So Dr. Paul Offit's in charge. God forbid there's an outbreak in India or somewhere. How would you in general approach it? What would be hopefully the way you would want to handle dealing with something international and also then for the American public? Because again, I guess the last thing I'm going to throw in, because to me it nauseates me, is that, you know, you have Robert Kennedy running for president, and I'm sorry, it's not the politics. It's just that, you know, all his conspiracy theories. And on top of that, on his short list is VP Aaron Rodgers, you know, who another, you know, conspiracy theorist. Unfortunately, the guys with the degrees that, you know, are losing the PR battle here. So what would you do? I mean, again, a hypothetical. Another zoonotic, we call it, you know, jumps from an animal to a person and whatever. How would you handle this international issue?
Okay, so do I get to be the czar of the United States or do I get to be czar of the world?
I'll give you the czar of the world. I mean, we are the leader of the world. But let's say you're going to have to navigate how to get India, or God forbid it's one of our enemies like Iran, that this is going on, but they know this thing is going to be bigger. I mean, that's what happened with China. This was bigger than they even realized, you know? Sure. So, I mean, you could pick China too, if you want. Yeah, it has to be the world, because the US, well, I want to get to that, because there are some things we probably could have maybe done. But anyway, I'll give you the world authority, and then we'll talk about how to protect the US.
So a few things. I think, first of all, you need to put in place an international team of scientists representing many countries that are going to be surveying moments like this. Well, I think pandemic viruses are created all the time. Mm. I think it just happens to be, it's like people that try and climb Everest, right? Everybody kept trying to climb, and then finally somebody did, right? And I think that's how I think of these pandemic viruses. I think they sort of happen all the time. And then one just at the right time at the right moment. So you need to have an international surveillance looking for these kind of viruses. That's why the Institute of Virology was there. It was there because it was a heavily trafficked region. It was an area where you had four wet markets that, this kind of event occurred. That's why they were there, to study that kind of thing. But I think you have to have international cooperation, because China was a terrible player in this. They didn't open themselves up to the kind of things we needed to get to find out what was going on, especially to isolate the virus. I think the best news about this pandemic is here's an unusual virus, right? SARS-CoV-2, unusual biological characteristics, unusual clinical characteristics. In 11 months, we did two huge clinical trials using a vaccine technology we had never used before. We had no experience with this to create two very effective and generally safe vaccines. That was, to me, the most amazing medical or scientific accomplishment in my lifetime.
It really is. People don't appreciate it. I mean, people waited, what was it, 5 to 10 years for the polio vaccine. You know, people were petrified and died. You know, I just read, by the way, I just have to throw this in, this thing that they showed on the cover of the New York Times, a man, this was really incredible, 78 years old, who just passed away. Did you see that? He was in the iron lung.
Since he was six years old.
Oh, my God. I mean, for our listeners, if you know, again, in my training, I trained at a hospital that was a very old hospital in New York, St. Luke's Roosevelt, and they actually had an iron lung in the basement, and we had to use it on a patient once when I was in training. And this thing looks like you're going into a small missile, and you have to stay there for hours. And this guy lived, obviously, his entire life to 78 years old, you know, and that's what petrified people back. I know my father's day when, you know, he was in his teens or whatever, the kids were afraid to go to summer camps and all this stuff too, to get getting polio, you know. So to come up with a vaccine in a couple of months or whatever is beyond phenomenal. But let me ask you this, though. If, again, you were the czar, and you, let's say you heard about what happened in China. Now, you know, obviously we don't have the best relations with China as we don't with Russia. I guess so you do need that international team, because most places can't handle this themselves. Is that right? I mean, again, and what would you have done in China? Would you have tried to seal off? I mean, is that what they did with the other earlier COVID ones? Like, they were very deadly, the MERS one. I mean, were they able? Because, you know, the other ones just killed people so fast. That's why it didn't spread. You just died and there's nothing to spread. You were dead. This, you know, kept going. So what would you have done to help the Chinese deal with this?
Right. So first of all, Chinese has excellent scientists. They just need to be able to collaborate. I think so I think that I see this as multifaceted. One is you have to be able to identify these things when it happens, and it will happen. And then you have to sort of coordinate, because what happens in other countries happens here, right? No one's safe until everyone's safe. I think we have to be much more generous about those countries that are wealthy, that have the technological capacities to make vaccines for the world. We can make vaccines for the world. We don't, but we certainly could do that, but we should do that. Secondly, I think we need to communicate, because you learn as you go. And people have trouble understanding that notion that you don't know everything at the beginning. Right. That when, for example, Dr. Fauci takes a second course of Paxlovid, when he's already really in the immune phase of illness where it's probably not going to make much difference, it's okay to get things wrong. The bivalent vaccine was not an advance over what we already had. Say it wasn't a bad idea. It just wasn't any better than what we had. You learn as you go, and people are intolerant of that. I think if you ask people, do you think you're going to know more 50 years from now about science and medicine than you know now, everybody would say yes, but they want to believe you know everything you need to know.
That's
now. But you don't, because you don't. You know, people lose faith. And so we have to explain the scientific process is a learning curve. And I think that would be what I would do as the
Well, as you know, too, one of the huge problems in that whole thing too is the backdoor thing. I think when COVID broke out, it was like one of these big Chinese like holiday times. And I don't know, for some reason, a lot of them were going to Europe, and a lot of them were in Europe, Chinese, residents. And then they came back in from Europe through New York and the East Coast. I mean, so it was like, would you almost like say, let's say we had really good cooperation. We said to the Chinese, say, look, this thing looks like within a radius, you know, it's almost like a bomb. You know, this is within a radius of like, you know, 100 miles of Wuhan. Let's seal off these residents. Otherwise, we're going to have a world pandemic. I mean, is that doable? I mean, again, this happened in India. No. No way.
I don't think so. It's really hard to touch. Okay. I mean, once these viruses start to cross borders, you're
screwed.
In New York, you know this better than me, when, you know, there was outbreaks in Italy and people from Europe would then travel to New York. And there was a huge outbreak in New York City because of that travel. It's very hard to prevent that. But I think what you can do is we made a vaccine quickly. We made antivirals and monoclonals quickly. I think convalescent serum was underused, really, considering that that's all we had, really, at the beginning. We had that from day one, and I think we underutilized that. We tended to treat just hospitalized patients, which was a mistake, because you were already, you know, the viral replication phase was already sort of passed because you were hospitalized with symptoms. We should have treated people earlier in their illness. But we learn as we go, and I think, and I would communicate. I mean, like in 2009, when there was a swine flu pandemic, Richard Besser was the head of the CDC, and he was great. He was out in front of the media every other day. Here's what the virus is. Here's what the vaccine. Here's where we are. And I saw him at a recent meeting, and I told him that. You did great in 2009. He said, thank you very much. I could never do it today. Two reasons, social media and politics. So I think you are up against things these days you weren't before. But
well, you know, going back to, again, like the RFK stuff and all the nonsense, you know, I was reading again. I mean, honestly, former President Trump should have been way out there. I mean, his life was saved. I mean, when we read more and more details, they said he was close to being intubated. He was very sick. You know, it wasn't really revealed. He maybe didn't want to, you know, affect his image. He was got the Regeneron, you know, monoclonal antibody, you know, before anybody, before it was even approved for anyone. And unfortunately, like Chris Christie, who does admit he was also in an ICU in New Jersey, very sick. I think he got it also, or maybe got plasma. And, you know, it's really imperative that these people obviously take front and center about getting vaccinated. About, you know, I mean, a lot of, unfortunately, you know, people who follow former President Trump were against the vaccine. I mean, if this is your hero, this saved his life. I mean, you know, the treatments. And I just think that we do need a little bit of better PR in the medical community versus what else is out there, you know, to, right.
I agree. Although once you're hospitalized, whether it's Chris Christie or Donald Trump, the monoclonal or the convalescent serum is not going to make much difference. What saved Donald Trump's life was the dexamethasone.
Oh, you think so? That's what it was, really? Interesting. Well, you know, what's interesting, just you bring that up too, just for our listeners, dexamethasone is a very powerful cortisone. And, but one of the things I like to emphasize to patients, because the way you were explaining that basically the two phases of COVID, the viral replication and then the inflammatory stage, which comes after. Sometimes I've found, I knew even a friend of mine personally had gotten the oral steroids very early and he had a much worse course. So it's like, it's almost like timing is very important in this
of
as well.
Of course. That's exactly. First of all, you don't want to take a steroid
when your body needs to fight. Right.
Against you. Right.
Yeah.
Only when the virus is starting to come down, and now it's right. Your trying to dampen.
I think you would agree with me. You know, when I teach the medical students, I'm fortunate I get to teach in New York the immunology section for a few days each year. And I always tell them, you know, I say, look, you know, you may not remember everything I teach you. I said, but what I am asking you to know, realize over the next several decades, that the language of immunology and probably genetics are going to be the two most important things in your career. And I know it's served me well, because if you don't do some of that basic thinking and understanding, you're misapplying medications and treatment for patients. And, you know, and you're not going to really get the optimal results.
I agree. I think understanding sort of pathogenesis, it's not like the Rosetta Stone. And then you don't have to sort of just go through this like memorizing bugs, drugs. I mean, just understand the way it works at its base. Right.
Yeah. Gosh, I always love talking to you. This is like, you know, this is like selfish of me. I get to talk to the person who I idolize. But in your book, Tell Me When It's Over, what would you really like anyone in the public who's going to read something, you know, because I'm sure there'll be family fights about COVID and vaccines and Paxlovid, that what do you want them to take away from it? Or that maybe, you know, should review in the book?
It was cathartic for me to write because I was on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee. And I think we got things right, and I think we got things wrong. And I'd like to think we've learned from that going forward. And the virus is going to be with us for decades, if not longer. So that's it. It's sort of a review of what happened, where we were, where we are, and where we're heading. But I do think it is a mea culpa at some level of things that we definitely could have done better.
Yeah, I think Dr. Fauci would have done well if he was able to co-write this with you because he protect his legacy. The poor guy, he put in 40 years or 50 years to the NIH, did a lot of good things, and he leaves with this.
He's
nonsense.
A good guy.
He is, I know. I mean,
all of us got it wrong at some point. All of us.
Commented on this guy's and point. Right, you know, like you said, medicine is a dynamic situation. It's not static, and that's why, you know, again, also like we tell all our residents that we teach our students that, okay, it's good to have a medical textbook. It's nice to have that, but keep up with all the journals and everything else too, because something new comes up every week.
Exactly.
Anyway, well, it was such a pleasure to have you on for a fourth time. I'm sure there'll be a fifth time because it doesn't sound like you're slowing down. Anyway, is there anything else where you want to send people to follow your work?
I have a Substack that I write every week.
That's really?
It's called Beyond the Noise. It's free. I didn't know that.
Beyond Noise.
Beyond the Noise, yeah.
Beyond the Noise. All right. I'm going to subscribe. I think everybody else should, too. And finally, for my listeners, please subscribe to our podcast, my podcast. It's been growing over the last 4 years. We've had phenomenal guests on, and I appreciate any nice, kind words you have to add. Thank you so much.